Continuing the chapter called Getting Burned on the Second Noble Truth, we come to the section on what Ajahn Sucitto has called the Ring of Fire, Dependent Origination. And the book, the great book, and the other copies are circling around, so this is the depiction of the Ring of Fire, Ajahn Sucitto's marvelously graphic rendering of dependent origination, burning, burning, burning. and so that you can pass that around and have a look. There's quite a few references to his images around the edge of the burning circle, so that's what I'm being referred to when he talks about the particular vignettes or single images. So before I begin with this section, I thought I'd also mention this book called, predictably, Dependent Origination by Venerable Paiuto. And so this, I would say, is the best book in the English language on the Buddha's teaching about dependent origination, and is very accessible and well translated and very reliable and useful as a practical guide. So we have many, many copies in the library. I can see our trusty librarian nodding vigorously. And so I do recommend that if you can't follow what I'm saying today, either go back to this book of Ajahn Sucitto's or look at this one from Tanchokun Paiuto. So, the Ring of Fire. The outer rim of this picture contains various figures bound up in loops of fire, mapping out the compounding of dukkha. These emblems represent 12 linking factors of an analysis called dependent origination, or paticca-samuppada in Pali. Just as studying the cause of suffering is helpful, as it will lead to understanding what we have to do or not to do, dependent origination provides many insights into the origin and cessation of suffering. It is a profound analysis whose terms and connections may seem baffling at first sight. Accordingly, I have drawn up a table for reference and recommend reviewing and reflecting on it while looking at the illustration. So here's his table, neatly arranged. In the picture, the interlinking motif represents another example of these vicious circles. With the first noble truth, the previous circle, the grasped aggregates reinforce and support each other. It was a chain. The experience of grasping and suffering, really two ways of looking at the same thing, are the force of torsion that creates those doubled loops. Torsion is a kind of tension between things. In the second truth, there is also a double-sided force, ignorance and desire. The interconnectedness of the loops points to the fact that, in dependent origination, each factor supports every other factor. Nor is the connection of one a simple causal sequence. Each factor that is described is present in every subsequently described factor, and the analysis is one of conditionality rather than causality. Just as water is a condition for ice, the absence of clouds a condition for a sunny day, having ears a condition for enjoying Bach fugues, so the conditionality of dependent origination is the structure of the potential for dukkha or its cessation. The essential point in this is that conditions arise in the present and can therefore be changed. Causes, on the other hand, are historical. So, causes from the past and conditions arise in the present qualities. So a few things to mention there before going much further. Many of you will have seen the traditional renderings of what's called the Bhava Chakra, or the Wheel of Birth and Death. You have a circular figure, and it's held in the grip of a large demonic figure that is Mahakala, which means great time. And that figure has the five or the six realms depicted as a sort of basic division at the central part of it. And at the very core, you have greed, hatred, and delusion, represented by the pig, the snake, and the rooster, or usually with each other's tail in their mouths at the very heart of that. around the edge of the either the five realms or the six realms, depending whether the asuras get mentioned, the jealous gods, you have the same system of 12 images that Ajahn Sucitto has used here. So his depiction in this graphic of his is very much, you know, following that traditional bhavachaka, or the wheel of birth and death, as sort of held within the grip of Mahakala. So I'm sure many of you have seen and noticed those images. And that image of the bhavachaka, the wheel of birth and death, seems to have been in existence within Buddhist tradition from very, very early times. It's not within the Theravada tradition, but within, I think, the Tibetan texts, they speak of it originally having been designed by Mahamoggallana himself, because he was so adept at visiting different realms of existence. He, in order to sort of portray what the different realms are like, the heavenly realms and the hell realms, the hungry ghost realms, the realms of the jealous gods, and as well as the immediately visible ones of the human realm and the animal realm, that it was Mahamoggallana who said, "Well, look, let me paint you a picture, and I'll show you what it's like." So that tradition has it that it was right from the very earliest times, and it's also one of those images that you find throughout the Buddhist world. So it's not just in the northern Buddhist world of Tibet or China, Japan, but you also find it in the Theravada countries in very, very similar forms. So it's a almost universal image. The next thing to say about, Ajahn Sucitto describes it quite well here, is when we recite the teaching on dependent origination, the words go avicca paccaya sankhara, sankhara paccaya vijnanam, vijnanam paccaya paccaya nama rupam. So this word paccaya means conditioned. So oftentimes when you read it, or you read about it, or hear about it, it can be presented or represented as saying, you know, A causes B, B causes C, C causes D, and so they use a term like a causal chain, and so that is overly simplistic and basically inaccurate, because the word paccaya just means condition. As he describes here, water is a condition for ice, but you need to have the water there for ice to appear, but you can't have ice without water, but there's other factors involved as well. Or having ears is a condition for enjoying Bach fugues. So another of the chants that we do is called the conditional relations. And it describes, as a part of the funeral chanting, as we do with a dependent origination. And it lists what are called the 24 conditional relations: hetu paccayo, aramana paccayo, the root condition, and so forth. And those 24, I won't go into all of this in any detail, and I'm certainly not skilled in this whole area of Buddhist analysis, but you have 24 different ways that A can relate to B. So when it says paccaya, that connection of A relating to B can be any one of 24 different ways. And so that the fact A is related to B, it can mean that A is a direct cause of B, or it can mean that A and B arise together, or that the fact that water is in the ground, if you dig a hole, you will reach water in the ground. Your digging does not create the water, but you can't get to the water without the digging. So there's a causal relationship, but the A does not create B. The B is already there, but you can't get to B without A, and so on. So this is the area of Abhidhamma, which is dense and intricate, and I won't go into here, but just so that people get a general idea of, when we talk about dependent origination, that the relationships between the different factors, it's not a simple A causes B, B causes C, but they have these different nuances and different kinds of way that they affect each other. One of the other things that that is very, very helpfully articulated in this book, in a a passage that's called A Problem with the Word Nirodha. I probably cannot find it. It's in the appendix. Probably Appendix A, yeah. Yeah, here we are. Very good. Page 106, A Problem with the Word Nirodha, being cessation. And I'll get onto that a little bit later. But when you're looking at this dependent origination cycle, and it says when ignorance ceases, then sankharas cease. When avijja ceases, then sankhara ceases. The cessation, it means something that has started is then stopped. It has been happening and now it's come to an end. So we use the word cessation. But the word nirodha can also mean the non-arising of. So like when you say if there is a non-arising of ignorance, then there is the non-arising of conditioned formations, volitional formations. So that it's not that when ignorance ceases, then the sankhara ceases, or when sankhara ceases, consciousness ceases. But it also means if that doesn't arise, then these things don't arise either. So anyway, I'll leave that till later. So then Ajahn Sucitto starts to speak about the images. And the first one, ignorance, and the image is of a person holding the hand over their eyes. Right at the top is ignorance, avijja, the man with his hand in front of his eyes. People tend to take ignorance, quote unquote, as pejorative. However, it refers to a lack of gnosis, G-N-O-S-I-S, which is the word Gnostic, and also the Pali word jnana, for knowledge, is related to the Greek word gnosis, and meaning insightful seeing, as well as to foolishness and unknowing. It is summarized as not understanding the Four Noble Truths, or perhaps more accurately, not understanding their implications. That is, as long as there is ignorance, the mind still expects to find an experience that is completely satisfying and feels disappointed when things, quote, go wrong, unquote. There's a parable of a man eating a bag of chili peppers one by one, weeping at their fiery taste as he does so. This is a Mullah Nasruddin story. And so that they see Mullah Nasruddin sitting there, weeping, tears streaming down his face with a bag of chili peppers, eating one after another. When asked why he continues to eat the peppers, he replies, "I'm looking for the sweet one." This is ignorance. Might be very endearing. But also, again, the English word ignorance usually means not having the information, not being aware of some particular, a way something is done. Like, I'm ignorant of how to make a good souffle. I don't have the information. I don't have the knowledge. But the Buddhist word avijja, in a way, it's technically correct, like there is not any knowing, but also the English word unknowing, or nascience is another word that is more accurate, because it's in a way it's a lack of awareness rather than not having the information. It's like a not seeing clearly, not being fully aware, not being fully awake, rather than not having the information. So someone can still not know how to make a souffle, but they can be their heart can be totally free of avijja. They can have full awareness, but not have the information about some particular activity or practicality. The Buddha said that it's impossible to find the origins of ignorance. However, with experience, one can see that it is increased by willfully ignoring the way life is, and substituting instead wishful fantasies based on the viewpoint of a self imagined to exist within the five khandhas. Dependent origination teaches that this view, its origins, purposes, and results, can be seen as dependent on many factors, all with ignorance as their foundation. The cycle of dependent origination works both ways. With the arising of ignorance and the acting on that, suffering follows. With the ending of ignorance is the ending of every kind of inner pain, shadow or stress. The uplifting aspect of dependent origination is that it brings the ending of dukkha down to one practice, that of replacing ignorance with wise attention. And as I was saying yesterday, Lumpo Samedo summarized this in a very neat formula. If you start out with ignorance, with avijja, you end up with dukkha. If you start out with vijja, with awareness, then you end up with nibbana. So you can put that on your fridge, bumper sticker. There will be forthcoming, I'm sure. So ignorance is a mental inclination of ignoring. It's not just a passive quality, although it may occur through a programmed impulse rather than a clearly conscious choice. If it were not something that was inclined towards, there would be no way of stopping it. However, a lot of the time, one is not conscious of ignorance. One thing about ignorance is that one is often ignorant of it. Important point. Reactions appear to happen automatically, without the awareness of where the motivation lies. When awareness is not developed to the point of knowing the mind, the automatic, quote-unquote, and reflex, quote-unquote, operations of our mind create the reality of our world. The inclination to not notice, to ignore, arises dependent on dukkha. We don't want to know about things not fitting in with our wishes, although there's no reason to assume that life should or could ever be the way we'd like it to be. So, ignorance affects our perceptions, the way we see things. If we're honest, we may notice prejudices, errors of judgment, definite biases towards seeing things my way. Also, ignorance distracts. What one doesn't want to know about is ignored. One's mind filters out flaws in a loved one's behavior, for example. Sometimes it's more conscious. They say the captain of the ocean liner, the Titanic, was informed of icebergs floating in the sea in front of his ship, yet chose to ignore the warning and went straight into them with the resultant death of almost everybody on board. He was busy making a record-breaking crossing of the Atlantic and didn't want these pesky icebergs to interrupt his achievement, so they say, allegedly. Notice that there was an element of choice in the matter. Many accidents are caused by people not being attentive, thinking about something else with a chainsaw in their hand, doing things automatically, and that inattention is due to our minds wanting to be somewhere else. Sometimes ignorance is deliberate and willful. Sometimes it could be prevented by being more attentive. Sometimes it's ingrained in the ways we perceive things and requires insight and the courage to undergo personal change to remedy. However, ignorance is always activated by some element of conscious or unconscious desire. Therefore, ignorance and desire are the axis which allows the wheel of fire to spin. So, tanha, and you have this expression that you come across regularly in the suttas, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. So that those two, tanha and avijja, are like a grim partnership. Also, one other point on this about as he says, one thing about ignorance is that one is often ignorant of it. Oftentimes, people say in this respect, well, how are you supposed to be able to approach or work with greed, hatred, and delusion? That greed and hatred are very easy to see; they're very vivid and highly apparent. They're sort of greed, I want more, or hatred, I can't stand, I've got to get away from it, I've got to get rid of it. So greed and hatred are quite visible, but moha or delusion, or in this respect, ignorance, which is the root of moha, how do you see delusion? How do you see ignorance? Because the very means whereby you would see it is not available to you. It's like, it's dark, so you can't see because it's dark. So when people ask about this, my response is to say, well, this is where spiritual friendship comes in. This is where your friends and your companions will say, do you realize what you're doing? Or that's a rather strange thought. Or do you really believe that? And it's through our our companions in the spiritual path, that we have that light, say, turned on for us, or we recognize, oh, I'm not seeing clearly, or yeah, I'm really in the, no wonder I'm bumping into things, I'm in the dark here. Huh. And we are more able to reach for the light. So continuing, as long as there is ignorance, actions tend to become automatic, compulsive, idiosyncratic, related to my way of seeing things, rather than to the needs of a situation. Ignorance, therefore, is linked to volitional or karma-productive tendencies, or sankhara, which includes activities of body, speech, or mind. Sankhara are here symbolized by the hand brandishing the hammer at the forge of creation, so like a blacksmith wielding a hammer. Also, sankhara means it comes from the root of to make or to compound or to put things together. So you have the hand holding a hammer, beating something into existence on the anvil of creation. We're always creating. When we speak, we create ourselves in another person's mind. And so it is with our actions. Ignorance conditions actions and makes them into activities of a self. When there is ignorance, we act, consciously or unconsciously, in order to prove ourselves or enhance ourselves. We also measure actions and speech in terms of self. We expect results, progress for ourselves or others we have identified with. We defend and justify our actions or assign to them a significance that they may not have. Alternatively, we may be highly self-critical. The self-view of sankhara means that we fail to measure the true worth or effect of actions and thoughts. Thereby, it strengthens the habit of acting in unreflective ways. We do not clearly notice the motivation behind action, or the impersonal and changing natures of the energies and perceptions that feed them. Action becomes habitual activity and starts to form our identity. Do you find that your life has repeating patterns in it, similar scenarios with different people involved? We seem to go through the same emotional cycles around different events and have recurring patterns of thought, the same memories, the same habits, so we think, that's the way I am. Habitual activities, even thoughts in the mind, are elements which forge the karma, the self-defining and binding activities that shape our lives. Any identity, good or bad, is subject to stress, frustration, sorrow, and death. If the karma is unskillful, there are a lot more problems on the way, such as guilt, fear, and the hostility of others. Then we act in ways to cover up or redress previous actions, again, acting from self-view. Thus, more karma is established, strengthening the sense of identity, good or bad. This is the proliferating effect of sankhara. It's only when we understand motivation is coming from energies such as greed or love, rather than an existing self, that we find the still point of reflection and pull out of the spin. That freedom gives us the opportunity to act and speak in an unbiased way, in the way of Dhamma, rather than sankhara. But also another way of relating to sankhara, again around its sort of the sense of things being compounded or brought together. It's like when there is ignorance, when the mind does not see clearly, then there it creates the basic seed of subject-object duality. So a sense of a me here and a world out there. There's a subject here and an object there. There's a me here and a world there. And so sankhara is also called the compounded things or conditioned things. And that compoundedness can be seen in that duality of self and other. So then the next one is vijnana. The sixfold sense consciousness is the agent through which sankharas manifest. This is the next link, symbolized by the monkey in the third loop. Ajahn Sucitto is very big on monkeys. So here we have it's a little monkey sitting there, representing the vijnana. Dependent upon habits, reflexes, and viewpoints that have been created, the monkey jumps, Seeing, hearing, thinking, tasting, smelling, and touching are sent running around this way and that. Consciousness is based upon the six sense organs and described as eye consciousness, ear consciousness, and so on. It can also be defined in terms of how it is propelled. Interest and attraction towards a sense object is consciousness rooted in greed. Generosity is a consciousness rooted in non-greed. Aversion to a sense object is consciousness rooted in hatred. Love is the opposite. Mind consciousness may experience a lot of confused, wavering activities around its sense objects of thought and emotion. This is consciousness rooted in delusion. Consciousness may be refined to varying degrees, from just above coma to sleep, wakefulness, caffeinated highs, alcoholic wooziness, ecstasy, or the refined absorptive states arising through concentration. For liberation from suffering and enlightenment, the Buddha stipulated that the mental consciousness should be unclouded and attentive, and that the quality of intention should be known and trained. It is intention that directs the monkey. There's a passage from the Sanyutta Nikaya. Bhikkhus, whatever we determine, whatever we intend to do, and whatever we are occupied with, this is the base for consciousness to be maintained on. Intention, chetana, and sustained attention, manasikara, produce the experience of conscious motivation. Motivation in terms of greed or hatred or confusion will send consciousness deeper into those realms. Motivation in terms of giving and love and intelligence will incline consciousness towards more positive states. This is how karmic tendencies are strengthened. However, good or bad motivation in terms of self will always heighten that sense of self and the inevitable dukkha which that entails. So that's saying even if you have a wholesome intention of developing love or kindness, generosity, compassion, if that's based on self-view, then that will also entail dukkha as its final result, as I've been emphasizing. Consciousness always works in terms of name and form, nama-rupa, which is the next section. Something only has presence, i.e. enters consciousness, because there is a sense of contact. Sorry, and contact depends on something contacted, form. From that contact, designations, feelings and perception, nama, arise. Nama is defined as feeling, perception, contact, intention, and attention. The neutral factors that pick up, define, locate, and react to the data of consciousness. Even formlessness is a designation of a kind of indefinite form. So the world of form only has presence for us because of consciousness, and how we perceive it is very much affected by the mind states, attitudes and feelings that we have. There is a saying that when a pickpocket meets a saint, all he notices are the saint's pockets, if he has any, of course, or she. When an architect or a builder sees a house, a different set of perceptions arises than when a homeless person sees it, or a burglar, or an animal. In a way, we build our own world, and our world builds us. What we are conscious of molds and determines the perceptions and attitudes we have. If you were attacked by a dog when you were a child, you probably will have some difficulty in perceiving dogs as loyal friends. So this is very true. Many years ago, when we first were renovating Chithurst House back in the early 80s, we were the roof was very broken down, and lots of old worn out tiles and holes in the roof. So we were replacing, and then the roof timbers had lots of dry rot in them. So we were replacing the whole roof, and we had professional roofers to do all the felting and battening and tiling. But the monastic community, we did a lot of the other work around the edges, including the gutters. And I was the gutter snipe. My job was to do the gutters. And so during this summer, I think it was 1982, we were doing the roof there. And so I spent many, many weeks clambering around the scaffolding and putting in these plastic gutters and joining them up and learning how all the different pieces work together and cutting them to size. So I spent weeks and weeks and weeks focused on the gutters at Chithurst and getting the levels just right. And so, of course, whenever I went away from the monastery, All I started to notice everywhere I went was gutters. I said, "Oh, there's cast iron ones. Oh, how do they connect that hopper to the downpipe?" And so I was seeing gutters everywhere I went. And yeah, also about dogs. You know, my parents were both dog breeders, so I grew up with a house full of dogs. So whenever I meet a dog, wherever, dog equals friend, because I grew up in a dog loving house. And not everybody has that experience. The thing that most profoundly affects consciousness, with whose rhythms and energies we are very much engaged, is the body. To be present in the sensory realm requires a physical body which has its needs, pleasant and painful feelings, its sickness and death. So, consciousness depends on and directs physical form, and is infused with attitudes and perceptions about it. Hence the fourth vignette, the body, is the connecting point for consciousness in the human world. So let's go back to that. So that's just and Ajahn Sucitto seems to be very male oriented. All his all the figures in his pictures are masculine, and all the people in his stories and examples are masculine. He does actually have a strong connection with the nuns community and the women of the world, but they don't kind of come through his writing very much. As just as most of his examples about sensual indulgence sort of hark back to his student days, and it's most about, you know, beer and parties is his sort of the immediate sort of go-to image for having fun. So since he kind of came out of university and after a brief time as a wandering hippie, then he became a monk. So these, speaking of perceptions that get formed into our worldview, then Ajahn Sucitto has his own particular patterns. So anyway, the fourth vignette is a bloke. A kind of a bloke just sitting there. And then the fifth vignette symbolizes the five external senses that relay information to the mind. So you have this a six-pointed kind of star with a question mark in the middle. The fifth vignette symbolizes the five external senses that relay information to the mind. The sixth vignette is of contact, the connection that is necessary for consciousness and its images to arise. So that contact is an electrical plug, through a three-pin plug, and then two hands meeting finger to finger, and a light bulb. So it's a very interesting relationship to electricity. And so the sort of contact from finger to finger symbolizing the completion of the circuit and the light coming on. So that's his image for passa, or contact. So let's... In the human birth, consciousness is programmed by bodily life. It constantly registers the pain that is a warning of injury to the body, and pleasure that is a signal for the preservation and development of the body. But the body inevitably experiences degeneration and death, making pain unavoidable and pleasure ultimately futile. When there's ignorance, consciousness remains fettered to this sensory realm, because the dependent link is not seen as biological or purely a matter of how the system works. It's felt as me, I appear to be a mental consciousness within a physical form, trying to seek solutions or remedies to it, or get as much agreeable experience as possible. Even if I am trying to get out of the physical form into some deathless or ethereal realm, I am always designated in terms of bodily presence or absence, because of consciousness affected by self-view, being attuned to bodily life. Consciousness is dependent on the body for a lifetime. So no matter how ethereal the mind state, you still have to attend to the coarse functions of the body and be with its pains, its insatiable needs, and its demise. The I am view associated with the body is always one of need, anxiety, or pain. However, when one key log, the sense of I, is removed from this pile of dukkha, bodily life becomes an opportunity for bringing wisdom and compassion into the world. In the vignette of the six senses, Salayatana, depicted by the arrows and the central question, I've tried to illustrate what is the one direction of Buddhist mind training. Sense consciousness normally takes us out towards objects or to thinking about what we can contact through the physical senses. However, in developing mindfulness, attention can be trained to look back into the mind, to focus on the intentions and reactions that govern conscious thought, speech, and action. So that you have this image of these sort of six different things pointing in from different directions and a question mark in the center. When you see something, you are aware of the seeing and you reflect, how am I seeing that? If you're thinking or feeling something, rather than just acting upon it impulsively, you reflect, how do I react to that? This is a way you can learn about what is skillful or harmful, what the attachments and compulsions are, and where the sense of identity is being created. It's a way to investigate who we are beyond our fluctuating and unsatisfactory identity. Who is the one who can freely contemplate the sensory world? There is always an awareness of something in the domain of consciousness, even if it's the feeling of confusion, suffering, or desire. But awareness has no personal identity. The simple equation is that truth has no personal identity, and personal identity has no truth. Another way of representing that, when this area is being talked about, we have this feeling of I am stuck in a prison. I'm limited. I'm bound. So there's this feeling of I want freedom, and I want to break free from the prison of these limitations of the body and the mind, the personality, the world. But the irony, the painful irony, is that I can never be free. The person can never be free, because we don't realize that it's actually the person that is the prison. And as Ajahn Sucitto articulates here, it's when we can get that particular log, the sense of I is removed. When the I is taken out of the picture, then freedom is possible. So, an easy way to remember is it's like the bars of the prison is I. Works very well. It doesn't really work very well in French or German or other languages, but it's very neat in English. So to continue, and I realize this is pretty dense stuff, speaking of dukkha and ignorance, but we'll continue, and I won't try and get through the whole lot today, but let's just go up to the next couple of sections. We can continue this chain through contact, passa. That's the way that the senses operate. Apart from the physical needs and use of having contact, the inferred self needs contact to maintain its presence. Self always exists in contrast to otherness. We get bored with the same old tastes, sounds, sights, people. But then sometimes it's nice to have the familiar. Can't live with you, can't live without you. Sounds familiar? If you really want to contact the forms of your psyche, you could try floating in a sensory deprivation tank. Or, more simply, sit where it's quiet and close your eyes. The natural inclination of the senses to make contact will bring up mental phenomena. For unenlightened beings, these will all be taken as aspects of themselves, and therefore unsatisfactory. However, the practice of sitting quietly with the eyes closed in meditation is useful in that, with steady attention, one realizes that all this stuff is something that can be watched, and is therefore a series of objects, not the subject. Not a self. We only experience contact because of feeling and perceiving something, and as what is felt or perceived must always be an object, how can we ever contact our true self? Hence, contact affected by ignorance is the launching pad for need or disappointment. From this contact arise the futile attempts to find ourselves or connect with our true feelings. Yet contact itself does not have to be dukkha. When there's no ignorance or self-view, contact provides opportunities for attention, insight, and sharing. Contact links up with feeling, vedana, and with characteristic Ajahn Sucitto-esque gruesomeness, the image for feeling is an arrow in the eye, like King Harold at the Battle of Hastings. getting an arrow in the eye. Contact links up to feeling, the arrow in the eye. Something strikes visual consciousness and a feeling arises which is either painful, pleasant, or neutral. It is said that the body only experiences painful and pleasant feeling. The eye, ear, nose, tongue, and tongue only experience neutral feeling, and the mind experiences all three. However, as the mind will interpret neutrality as pleasant, calm at some times, and painful, tedious, or dull at other times, in normal consciousness, one is dealing with mental feelings based on perceptions. For instance, people can derive pleasure from doing extremely stressful things to their bodies. It's a real problem that the mind's values, sanya, can get so distorted that we actually derive pleasure from bragging, abusing, and fighting, even though these are abrasive and violent feelings in mind consciousness. Powerful emotional pleasure may arise out of being attractive, even though attractiveness can be stressful in terms of cost, artifice, and competition, and quite dangerous if you attract the wrong kind of person. Then there are the feelings associated with winning, being excited, and so on. The pleasure of these feelings is not due to the mind as a sense organ, which may even crack up under the strain, but to confused perceptions. The most consistent determinant for feeling is whatever sensation or perception makes me feel important, sensitive, or powerful. When there is ignorance or unknowing, we don't really know what we're feeling. As I've suggested above, much of the time we're in contact with our perceptions because they can create images in accordance with desire. Such is the next loop of fire, craving, which is tanha in its fully conscious form. Here it's represented by the thirsting mouth and the hand always reaching out to get water from a perceived mirage. It's the image of Tantalus from another sort of slightly glassy-eyed bloke, like Tantalus, who was chained up to a rock in a lake, but the water was always just below his chin. So no matter how he tried to reach down to the water always sank down low. And he leaned back, then the water would rise up. So that's where we get the English word tantalizing from. It's from Tantalus, who was a character out of the Greek myths, who had annoyed the gods for various causes. So, when there is ignorance or unknowing, such is the next loop of fire, craving, which is tanha in its fully conscious form. Here it's represented by the thirsting mouth and the hand always reaching out to get water from a perceived mirage. Feeling links to desire. If what is felt through the senses is not desirable or brings up aversion, the unawakened instinct creates a fantasy that is attractive. One of the bitterest aspects of the unawakened life is that when you have enough physically, your mind creates fantasies to crave. Nowadays in Western culture, our normal reality is composed of fantasies vividly portrayed on television, in movies, novels, shows, and advertisements. This is pre-internet. So little did he realize what was coming down the road, pre-internet, pre-iPhone. Man, maybe should have a little footnote for the 2015 edition. Yeah, you ain't seen nothing yet, Ajahn. They seem harmless enough, but the contact with them and the feelings they induce unconsciously affect our values. People end up voting for a fantasy, being governed by a fantasy, using fantasy money, having fantasy enemies, and chasing fantasy goals. The only real element left is suffering, but that is repressed or not acknowledged because it doesn't fit into the fantasy. In the brave new world, everybody's happy, ignore the rest. Without ignorance, desire is not suffering. We can understand desire. It is something that we can watch in order to know its ethical quality. We can act on skillful desires with dispassion. We can respond to the signals of bodily need, and we can let go of desires that are born from greed, hatred, or delusion. Then we're not acting in ignorance, and we can use the energy of desire to investigate the mind and bring goodness into the world. Another aspect of this whole process And in the Thai forest tradition is one of the most common themes when talking about dependent origination, is that the weakest link in the whole causal process is seen to be between feeling and craving, this link of Vedana and Tanha. That up to that point, that the whole process works so subtly and so quickly that in a sense, before we know it, there is the sense of a me here and a world out there, and me running away from the things that are frightening or contending against the things that are disliked or chasing after the things that are liked. And so that in a way the potency of ignorance is such that we kind of don't really come to until we hit the realm of feeling, that the senses are operating and the feeling of me here and the world out there, it's already up and running. And so that the first point where the process can be sort of caught or tracked for most people is at this link between feeling and craving, where Vedana connects with Tanha. And so much of the instruction of in the sort of forest tradition, the aim is to in a sense focus upon the realm of feeling and to notice when feeling turns into desire. And so that that it becomes a key element of practice, where the other day we were talking about how you can be in the presence of something that's painful, but you can also learn how not to hate it. Just because it's awful and painful doesn't mean that we have to hate it. So because someone's behavior is insulting or hurtful, we don't have to pile hatred upon them. It's still bitter, it's still uncomfortable, but the hatred that is put onto that is something extra. So we can know the feeling of pain without fearing it, without hating it, without creating suffering around it. Like I was talking about the Buddha having chronic back pain, and that it was a continual experience of discomfort, but he didn't create any suffering out of that painful feeling. And so this this aspect of the ring of fire, in a way, this is what one of the key places where you can break free, the breaking free of the ring of fire, the circle, is at that realm of the bridge between feeling and craving. And so that once that bridge has been crossed, and then you have the next elements that I won't go into today, but of craving, condition, grasping, conditioning, becoming, conditioning, birth. In a way, the process is getting sort of too strong, and the mind is getting too absorbed into the disliked object or the desired object, and so that there's a compulsion, or the mind is already pursuing that or fighting against it. So it's because of that tension in the system, it's less easy to see clearly. But at the realm of Vedana, of feeling, that's when the mind can still be most clearly aware and not caught up. So that's seen as the sort of key point in terms of a meditation practice, learning to recognize, oh, this is just the feeling of disliking, or this is the feeling of liking. And a story that's very often told is that Ajahn Chah at the Hampstead Vihara back in the 1970s, when it was one of those rare hot summer nights in London, and there was a big crowd of people gathered in the small shrine room in the Hampstead Vihara, and right across on the other side of the road is the Haverstock Arms, the pub. And being an active and busy pub in London, had loud rock music blaring out. And so as the group was gathered for the meditation, then for a while they'd sit with the windows closed, but then it was getting very, very hot and steamy, and then they'd open the windows, and then the music would be twice as loud, and then they'd have the windows open for a bit, and then they'd close the windows, and Ajahn Chah was just sitting there, completely still the whole time, not a flicker, nothing showing at all. And so there's the windows opening, windows closing, windows opening, windows closing. And he sat there for an hour and a half, letting people investigate the experience. And then at the end of an hour and a half, he rang the bell and said, you think the sound is annoying you, but actually it's you annoying the sound. And so that, in that little simple phrase, it captures so much, that it's because of the mind getting upset with a particular sense experience, then we create suffering out of it. If you just let it be a sound, you might not like it, but it's just a sound. There's no dukkha created out of it. So I will leave the presentation there for this evening. Still got a few more links to pursue, but I'll leave it there for now. But if there's any particular questions or things that could do with some clarifying, please don't be shy.
Buddhism sort of, why? It's a tricky subject, it's a tricky one. In Theravada Buddhism, the khandhas are not self. That's what I said, the khandhas are not self. But, and then it sort of goes that little step where it sort of hints that you might not be there, you know? It's in one way or another. Sometimes that sort of comes across.
It says, sabbe. Sankara anicca, sabbe sankara anicca, sabbe dhamma anatta, all dhammas are not self.
Not self, yeah. But it believes in the mind, and the mind can't be seen, or touched, or found. It believes in something that is not touched, found, or even a surgeon cannot tell you where your mind is.
Where is the wrong question?
Or what it is.
But it can know. That's the essentially practical aspect of the Buddha's teaching, that he didn't bother going into intricate philosophical explanations. He said you don't have to understand the origins of knowing, or what knowing actually is, but you know that you can know. That's what's important. So that I wouldn't say it's tricky. I mean, it's a subtle teaching, but it frustrates the thinking mind. So if you want to create a conceptual map, then of life, the universe, and everything, then you're going to be disappointed. But the Buddha's, I feel part of the Buddha's genius is to say, this is all you need to know, just this much. As he said over and over again, what I know is comparable to the leaves in the forest, or what I tell you is comparable to the leaves in my hand. It's a specifically limited amount that you need to know, and that you don't have to define the fundamental nature of the citta, what is the absolute nature of awareness, but that there can be that knowledge of there is awareness. The mind is awake, that's all you need to know.
So that signifies some form, this is the difficult bit, but the knowing quality doesn't age or sicken. It's constant. Consciousness, but whether we could say it was an existence, but we couldn't say it doesn't exist. So, you know, you've got the middle way, haven't you? Where either way, you would be wrong, and you both be right. You have two truths. So it's a sort of $24,000 question, isn't it?
Well, so there's a wonderful statement by the Buddha. He says, in Pali, it goes yena yena hi manyanti tatatang hoti anyatati, which means whatever you conceive it to be, the fact is always other than that. So what he was pointing to is that the reality is inconceivable, but we don't need to conceive it because we are it. It's like the waves discussing what the nature of the sea is. So that's why his emphasis on dukkha and the ending of dukkha is that is absolutely brilliant, because we don't have to have a conceptual map, but we can recognize this is disharmonious, this is harmonious, this is free of suffering, this is bound up with suffering, and that presence of dukkha is the sign that there is clinging going on, there's ignorance at work, and the absence of dukkha is the sign that there is no clinging going on, there is no ignorance there. So that it's a deliberately limited teaching, but is extraordinarily effective, because in this moment that you can see how the mind can create suffering by clinging, and if the clinging stops, the suffering stops. That's all we need to know. The thinking mind goes but. But it can do that. But the essential thing is dukkha and the ending of dukkha. That's and with that ending of dukkha, you still might not know how to make a good souffle, but it won't be a problem.
I suppose in the Heart Sutra it says, Kartai, Pasam, Kartai, Bhadiswara, gone beyond. Gone beyond what? Anything you want to pick up, it's gone beyond it. But that's hard to explain, isn't it? Because what worries me sometimes with Theravada interpretation is it's that denial of existence, which can be quite dangerous, or a permanent existence. We always go to say, well, there's not anything permanent, but it's that when you get that little bit near what really is all emptiness.
Well, that's a misunderstanding. That the Buddha deliberately said, I do not teach this as the annihilation of an existent being. Those who say that, they misrepresent me, and they do not say what I say. There's a categorically states that. But it's good being misunderstood. It's very good practice being misrepresented and misunderstood. It's very very fine spiritual training. Okay, I think that's enough. Tomorrow it's the anniversary of Lumpur Chah's passing away. Hence we have shrine for Lumpur and these different display boards that have been created. And so it's 23 years ago, on the 16th of January, Lumpur Chah passed away. So we'll be having tomorrow. I won't continue with this, but I'll be reading out some Lumpur Chah's teachings, just before the mealtime, and probably the morning reflection of the meditation, and then at this reading time in the evening, I'll be sharing some of Lumpur Chah's teachings during the day as a way of bringing his presence to mind and reflecting on his own words and his legacy to us, because of course none of this would be here, none of us would be here if it wasn't for him. This little guy sitting in the, going into the forest in Thailand, and saying, this life, I'm going to do it. whatever else happens, I'm going to give it my all. And so we are the fortunate inheritors of his resolution. So tomorrow will be a particular day to recollect Lumpur's teachings, and they have been gathering at the Wat Pa Phong over the last week, and so tomorrow will be the sort of main festival day, but they've been having a week-long period of group meditation and Dhamma talks through Wat Pa Phong. Several thousand people gather there every year. So that's enough for today.